Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of powerpoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today, Matt is joined by Captain Rogers, former commanding officer of the USS Ponce, a float forward staging base. He will talk about how his ad hoc crew of sailors and civilians took a 40-year-old ship from decommissioning's doorstep to being the most flexible ship in the Arabian Gulf. Sea Control is available on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. We think Sea Control is a very, very fine product, and anyone who says otherwise is going to steal all of your banking information and email passwords, because information should be free, man. Now, sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As always, I am your host, Matt Hipple, Director of Next War, and today we have a special guest. Captain John Rogers is the former CO of the USS Ponce, former LPD-15, became AFSB and AFSBI, a bunch of letters. Suffice to say, it's an amphibious platform that went from being in a almost decommissioned state to one of the most capable platforms in the Gulf in less than a year. So this is a real-life story about naval entrepreneurship, what service people around the world can potentially do with their own platforms and their own capabilities if they take it into their own hands and they get the trust and investment of their leadership. So today's story is going to be really exciting. Sir, it's a pleasure to have you.
Oh, it's great to be here, Matt. It's pretty inspiring to see such a young lieutenant take an interest in our maritime strategy and carry on these kind of programs. This is my first podcast, so I thought I'd practice with you and see where this goes.
Just for full disclosure, Captain Rogers is my boss. That said, that any positive statements I make are not me sucking up. They are 100% earnest. Captain Rogers is an incredible guy with some really good insights on the Navy. So, sir, if you could, as we do with each one of our guests, just introduce yourself, what you think are the most important beats. You know, we could read a bio. I think it's better for listeners to hear it from our guests themselves, who they see themselves as and what they think are the important beats.
Okay, I'm a son of a Navy chief. I was pretty much raised around the coasts of the United States, settled in Tennessee, graduated Cornell University. I'm a prior Nuke ET, and I guess things you don't read in a bio. I sold Bibles door to door for 2 summers to educate myself or pay for the tuition until the Navy picked up the tab. And so I often joke I'm a redneck with an Ivy League education, which means I watch NASCAR with a glass of wine.
Which figures your ability to put together something like the customized USS Ponce. So for our listeners, the USS Ponce, former LPD-15, was launched in 1970. So this is over 40 years ago that this ship was launched, and it is still operating today now as the AFSBI-1, so a float forward staging base 1. So we're talking about an incredible history of a ship that has now a very focused and modern mission. Sir, I guess to start out our conversation, describe to us the state of this ship when you showed up, and contrast that with the expectations that were given to you by your leadership. And for everyone listening, what's really important here is, sir, this was your first command. So you didn't get a standard command. You were handed something particularly irregular that involved a lot of really in-depth adaptation and outside-of-the-box thinking. So I think to give everybody a scope, give them where you started and where you were expected to be.
Well, I was a J3 chief of staff at UCOM. We just done Odyssey Dawn and Neo out of Libya with the Arab Spring, and I got the call to come and take this thing called a float forward staging base, and so I arrived to the ship in April. I took command April 16th, and we deployed 45 days later. The crew had arrived about 2 weeks prior to me, and that crew consisted of 220 people. And put that in context, the ship was commissioned 42 years ago with a billet base of 506 people. So we were, over the years, actually it declined about 360. She was manned down or optimally manned down to 360. So on March the 30th, 2012, she was scheduled to be decommissioned. And although we never held that ceremony, we did cash in those 360 billets. So then I got to the ship. I had 45 days to take 220 people, 140 less than she decommissioned with, and get her ready to deploy on a mission that was kind of unscripted. And, you know, there's been many ships do the missions as an afloat forward staging base over the years, but Ponce represented the first ship that was dedicated as an AFSB. So we got some time off Virginia, the Bay Capes there with the mine countermeasure folks, and the SOF came out, and that was about our training. And then, you know, 45 days after taking command, we embarked on a journey. The ship was in a, like you said, she was in a tough state. I mean, she was all but towed up the river. For all those that are familiar with decommissioning a ship, she was, well, the batteries were all removed, the battle lanterns, the wires were cut, the, fuses were pulled, and, you know, the descant bags were installed, and I think we caught her before the liquids were all drained out of her. She was in a tough state. But I'll tell you, the teamwork between the mariners and the sailors, it was remarkable. When I look back over the 22 months that I had her, it was an incredible journey.
Now, maybe you can flesh that out. The you mentioned the mariners. Now, for those who don't know, the USS Ponce is operating as a warship. Maybe a phase zero, phase one warship, but a warship nonetheless. It's USS. But it does have a large number of mariners. So maybe you could talk to that relationship and when you showed up, what that was like. For those who don't know, when we're talking about mariners, we're talking about civilians. So these are unionized civilians. These are engineers. These are not uniformed sailors, and they are operating side by side with our guys in uniform, doing a lot of the same jobs and supporting them.
Well, that's a good point. And, you know, like I said, we cashed those 360 billets in on March the 30th, 2012. So now you've got a ship without any billets. And how do you man a ship without billets? And so we call our mariner brothers, and they, use government civilians to man the ship, and also you rob the fleet to pay Ponce. And we had 55 sailors from worldwide commands that various skill sets that came in, and that's how we manned the ship. We call it hybrid manned. And for context, Ponce's the fourth hybrid manned ship that we have in our inventory. We have Mount Whitney over in 6th Fleet, that's hybrid, and then you've got the Frank Cable and the Emory S. Land out in 7th Fleet. But Ponce was unique because the crew was IA sailors. The sailors on the other three hybrid ships are all PCS. And the other uniqueness of the Ponce hybrid is I had a master on board as well, equivalent to an 06. He reported to me, and the chief engineer was an 06 as well. And he reported to me as an operational chain of command, all administrative stuff like payroll, overtime, union issues, grievances, or anything like that. That went up the administrative chain of command. So, you know, most ships have a triad, CO, XO, and a CMC. I often joke that we had a Pentagon on Ponce, where I had a XO, a senior enlisted leader, and a master, and a chief engineer. And that was a mutual respected relationship we had. And you know, I had four masters, during my time in command. And, you know, I'm Facebook friends with them today. We, you know, we had a steep, hill in front of us and we did well with it. So, yeah, that was the Manning profile. The Mariners covered down on engineering. They covered down on deck, navigation, and supply. The Sailors did the combat systems, the operations, the planning, C5I, and the force protection. And so that was how the roles were divvied up. And if you were a government civilian, I was held to ABS standards. And any departments in the military side, I was held to NAVC or OPNAV standards. So, you know, we were held to about every standard there is out there. And that was an interesting dynamic, especially when you look up and you're reporting to two ADCONs. We were my administrative chain of command was both SERFLANT and an MSC under the Admiral Busby at MSC, and he turned over to Admiral Shannon, and then I started with Admiral Thomas and now Admiral Gumatautau. Over in theater, I was OPCON to ESG-5, Expeditionary Strike Group 5, Admiral Fanta at the time, then he turned over to Admiral Lesher. And then when we pulled that flagpole out of the ground, I reported to CTF 51, which is Brigadier General Olson, Mars sent forward. So I had plenty of people I was reporting to over there.
Now, for some folks, just background, if you're not familiar with these terms, when Captain talks about ABS standards, he's talking about the American Bureau of Shipping. So we're talking about civilian vice military standards for employment. When he talks about PCS, he's talking about formal permanent orders. So if someone's TAD or IA, it's an individual augmentee or a temporary duty assignment. That means that person doesn't report to that command. He's from somewhere else and he's temporary. When he says PCS, that means they are directly, specifically under his command. So what he's talking about is essentially a lot of ad hoc crew members that'll be pulled from other ships and brought on board. And there's a whole series of layers of the different sort of, you talk about hybridized crew. Well, this is a very hybridized mission. And let's start first with some of the material challenges that you overcame and the solutions that your crew came to. And then we'll move to other things like operational challenges and adaptation and engagements with other countries. So to start small, considering what your guys accomplished, let's talk about the things that were required on board that didn't exist, that your crew was essentially able to construct themselves. So this isn't a drawing. There were no contractors. These were sailors building actual joint operations centers or offices inside of a ship. So very irregular from what we're used to in the United States Navy.
I will tell you, when we departed, Fleet Forces and SERFLANT, MSC, invested quite a lot of money into getting this 42-year-old ship up to standards. And a lot of that money, and you know, you never have enough money, but the money that was given was prioritized to, you know, things like HM&E, the hull machinery and the equipment that made the ship go. It didn't leave a lot of money left over for outfitting the ship. And so the challenge was, for instance, an example, we took all the computers and we had to re-image the hard drives to meet current standards, IAVA and security standards. And, you know, being on a decommissioned list for 5 years, there was no tech refreshing. So we had an 85% failure rate on the images. So, you know, I had essentially a big problem. I didn't really have a lot of money to outfit the ship with computers, but I had people, and one of those was my combat systems officer, Mike Toth. He's now the XO of Whidbey Island. And he was married. His wonderful bride worked at GIFCOM at the time. And that was about the time we were pulling that flagpole out of the ground. And she knew of a warehouse where there was pallets of computers from GIFCOM decommissioning, if you will. And so we got a few pallets of hard drives, and that was resourcefulness. That didn't cost us a dime. But that got us underway. We also went to Dermo, and we got tools. We outfitted our repair shops. We used spare parts. And if you came on board Ponce the morning of June 1st when we deployed, you couldn't see the decks in the well deck, the upper vehicle storage, and the lower vehicle storage because it was full of triwalls and pallets. And that was just the crew warehouse diving across the waterfront to find everything we could. And then we knew we had that transit time across the Atlantic to train, but also outfit the ship with mission spaces. Today, one of the biggest capabilities that Ponce brings to the theater is the command and control spaces. There's 8 mission spaces on there with over 130 workstations, 6 brand new circuits. There's a SIPR, 2 SIPR circuits, a NIPR, top secret, JWIX, and then of incredible note was Centrix. When we got in theater, we used Centrix a lot, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But on the subject of spaces and getting the ship outfitted to go, that was just deck plate resourcefulness. I mean, in a hurry. Some of the sailors went up to Philadelphia to our graveyard, if you will, where we keep some ships at anchor. And, we were able to get desks and weapons mounts. When we got to the ship, there was no weapons mount. So we had to get all that stuff and bring it down, and just sheer ingenuity of the crew got the ship ready to steam in Fifth Fleet waters.
And that's an important – you bring up an important point when it comes to the issue of Dermo. For those who don't know, there's a lot of material the military doesn't just throw away. If something gets updated, let's say you bought something 2 years ago and an update comes and now there's an entirely new piece of equipment, all that equipment still exists. It usually gets sent to Dermo for repurposing or sale. And in the military, was it you that told me never buy a tool? There's plenty of old tools that'll go there. So we usually concentrate when we think modernization and buying new platforms. We look at LCS and Zumwalton lasers. We all look at the new stuff, and we often forget that there is a large amount of old functional material that still exists in the military. You don't even have to buy it. So in a fiscally constrained environment, one of the big innovations, not even innovation, just things to be aware of for officers and enlisted and general leadership, is these warehouses full of old but usable equipment. And that was one of the things I thought was really interesting when I first heard your story, was your just ability to outfit this entire ship in 45 days or less to go over to the Gulf with just material other people had thrown away because of either some sort of administrative requirement or some checklist or something else. So that's something for people to think about. Sir, maybe if you could talk about, you often mention you talk about the personnel, so you talk about the sailors, and there's two parts to that. There's the skills mismatch because you're getting IAs, so you're getting whoever's available, and there's also the ingenuity on their part. Maybe you could talk to both of those topics, perhaps sailors that had to master skills that they didn't have before, or ways that you were able to use this very ad hoc crew in ways that more conventional thinking wouldn't have been able to.
Yeah, that's just one of the realities of IA crewing. I mean, basically out of the gate, there's no script for this. So I had some sailors, 55 of them, and about 80% were volunteers and the rest were voluntolds. But, they came to the ship and I remember parachute rigger, jet mechanic, those types of ratings you would never find on a ship of this class. But that's who I had. And you got to look at those individuals and their skill sets, and then you got to put them in a place where they could succeed. So, I didn't leave Norfolk with a polished battle bill or anything like that. I had to figure that out on the way across and how I was going to fight the ship. And I looked in my CIC, my Combat Information Center, which quite frankly looked like Sanford and Son's shed with 42 years of antiquated stuff, just all over the place. And there was just no rhyme or reason or no organization. And I just recall walking through there and I say, how can I expect these sailors that I'm about to place a huge burden on their shoulders? How can I expect them to stand a professional watch in such a dilapidated workspace? So when we were over there, one of our first voyage repair periods, we gutted combat. And basically I designed how we stood watch, how we were going to fight the ship. And we took it and gave the sailors free rein. I said, let's design this, and this will be the first ship in the Navy that was designed and built by a sailor and a mariner. When I say sailors, I meant mariners and military. We're all sailors. I kind of make that distinction between mariners and military, but that crew, and under 2 weeks, we gutted combat and we put it back together. I mean, it's hard to put in words the optic of that improvement. I do have before and after photos that I share in my post-deployment brief.
We'll put those up on the actual post on the website. So folks, if you're listening to this on the subscriber channel in iTunes or Stitcher Stream, go to simsec.org, look at the actual blog post for this, and we'll have those some of those before and after photos there. Sir, continue.
Yeah, if you're going to show those, then you can also put a visual on the before and after of how the ship was, and I don't say that in arrogance, and I don't want you to put that up there from that, but
no, of course not.
I hope the readership looks at that and I owe it to that phenomenal crew, those sailors and mariners that came together short order and deployed and, got the job done. I mean, there's a lot of sweat on that ship. And for them, as you look at those photos, see the amazing capabilities of our civilian mariners and our sailors. But, I did that combat, I made the decision to do CIC like that, and I didn't put any alteration requests or anything like that. I just felt it was my duty to do that. I had more than one sailor come to me and say, sir, we're not authorized to do this, or, I don't think we're able to do that. But I just felt like it was my job to get that ship. I could get a space in a condition where we could fight it. In retrospect, I wouldn't have changed a thing. We did it. A lot of, we got VIPs by the hour over there to visit the ship, and very impressed. And it really highlights the capabilities, the sheer capabilities of our sailors.
Absolutely. And for those who don't know, as an illustration of the amount of trust that's invested in the Ponce and what it is today, first deployable laser, I think, is there now. I think is being
well, not yet. I mean, I regretted that I couldn't be there for the laser. It's ironic, the newest technology on I think the second oldest ship, or third, counting the Constitution. But and the other benefit of rebuilding the combat was we were able to make room for that laser. We knew, I did all the ship, I was there for all the ship checks. And knew the consoles. We knew the electrical load and all that, and how it was going to interface with the ship. So, later this year, that will come alive on Ponce. That's an exciting capability, and I'll tell you, it makes the crew pretty proud to have that. We were excited when the CNO announced it.
Absolutely, and they should be proud. This is an incredible achievement. Now that we're moving on to the laser, we're talking about capability. So something that we really haven't touched on so far, we've talked about a lot of the changes to the physical ship itself, changes in the way that the crew operates in regards to how more conventional warship crews would operate. Talk to those capabilities. So we're talking about an amphibious assault ship designed during the Vietnam War And today it is now a multi-mission joint operational platform. You've got Apaches. I was there during IMCMEX, so that was incredible to watch the Ponce operate. So there is a whole slew of missions that no one even imagined that the Ponce would be conducting that you guys were able to do the inaugural attempts at. And maybe you could talk to some of those.
Well, I think you get to the core of what an afloat forward staging base is. And like I said earlier, you know, many ships have been afloat forward staging bases, but, Ponce, you know, the LPD-4 class over the years has been known the workhorse of the fleet. And the reason is, I mean, she's got an interface. You got to look at an afloat forward staging base. Her capabilities has got to be how she interfaces with the environment. You know, you've got a crane, you've got a flight deck, and you've got a well deck, whether it's a flooded well or a dry well. And those interfaces really are the core capabilities of what that ship brings to any theater. The permanence of Ponce being, you know, being permanently deployed over there, the permanence attracted a lot of these new technologies. I mean, the laws, the laser at sea. We had a Sterngate launch and recovery system that, you know, I saw from the drawing to execution, the mine countermeasure folks just an incredible capability to launch 11-meter rib off the Sterngate in 4 to 6 foot seas. It was very, very incredible. You know, we had some special stuff that came on board, and it was real. It was, you know, I asked them, you know, why Ponce? And they said, well, we don't like putting it on deployers because we got to take it back off when they leave. So that permanence really attracted those capabilities. But back to the float forward staging base and those interfaces with the environment. You know, with a flight deck, you can pretty much land anything in our inventory. And anything in our coalition partners inventory. The crane, you know, a 20 ton crane, there's not much it cannot lift and put into the water. And then a floodable well deck, it could take anything from an LCAC down to what we call our rubber rafts, the EOD rafts, you know, 7 meter ribs, 8.5 meter ribs, 11 meter ribs, sea lions, the LCUs. You know, that well deck, flight deck, and crane is what makes that base so incredibly desirable in Fifth Fleet. And when I say desirable, there was always a food fight at the scheduling conferences for Ponce. That's how much in demand the AFSB was over there.
Now, perhaps what were some of the capabilities that you were surprised the ship was able to conduct or that you were asked to do? Things off the beaten path that you didn't think would be on the plate for your crew.
Well, I think the ship is the ship, and what allows it to succeed is the attitude of the crew. I mean, when you take, let's just take the International Mine Countermeasure exercises. We did 2012 and 2013. We had over 33 nations for the 2012, and in 2013, I think we hit over 40 nations. And, you know, and with the sole mission of removing that mine menace from the waters. So when you take the R&D budgets of all those nations and you have all those gadgets and you see it come together in this instance, it basically came together on Ponce, all this stuff, all their mine countermeasure technologies, you know, and they don't all come on, you know, 110 power or 440 or, you know, the plugs are different, just like when you travel to Europe. And the attitude of the mariner engineers, the deck departments, the sailors to want that to succeed. And like I said, the ship is a ship, but that attitude of the crew that could take, hey, you know, we have this. Can we plug it in? How can we get power? I need this pressure of potable water to this Connex box as a fire suppression system for these batteries, special batteries, you know, all that stuff. it culminated on Ponce during that, those IMC MXs. That was really exciting. And I got to tell you, I was really impressed by the attitudes of the crew and the embarks. And I'll tell you, when you eat in the wardrooms and the mess decks with the Aussies and the French and the Brits and have all those cultures coming together like that, it's never a boring second. That was a lot of fun, a lot of fun. So Matt, to sum it up, the crew's attitude with that awesome capability of, platform interface was what made it successful.
Now, when you went into this, there was an understanding that this was an irregular mission. What sort of relationship or what are the differences between normal conventional chain of command, not chain of command, it's a bad term, but command and control versus what the Ponce required to have this kind of level of adaptability? So what was your interaction, this kind of leadership? What did you find surprising, or what did you find refreshing and helpful that your leadership did and in many cases did not do that allowed you to do all of these kinds of missions and get this ship brought up to snuff?
Well, I touched on the what we call the C2, the command and control, the opcon, the adcon, the taccon. I'll spend a few minutes on taccon. Whenever we embarked a combined task force over there, I was usually taccon to them. When their stuff, if they did not embark and their stuff came on board, whether it's Apache helicopters, riverine control boats, or any other C2 stuff, they were tack on to me. So that's pretty much how you have to understand command and control. Anybody that's worn a uniform understands that that's key.
For those, just give me a second. That's a good point. For those who haven't, ADCON, administrative control, that means I sign your fit reps essentially being your the review of how well you did. OPCON is operational control, and TACCON is tactical control. So for those that maybe aren't hip to the lingo, there you go. So, sir, sorry for interrupting. Yeah. Please continue.
But that's what, that's the org chart. That's the box with the bold and the dotted lines, and you understand who reports to who and with what function. But what I felt was probably the most enabling attribute of the command was the trust that my bosses put in me and put into the ship. I was not micromanaged. I had a ship, I had a crew, a unique crew, I had a mission, and I had the trust. And that's what else does a SWO want, a surface warfare officer want in this Navy? But that's reciprocal as well. I had trust in my chain of command as well. It was my job to keep Ponce off the whiteboards of all those I reported to. Once I was given the mission, the attitude of the crew was how we could, not why we can't, why we couldn't. We had to say no, sometimes. Just the minimal manning, the environment, the heat over there. We had to keep operations within a 12-hour crew day because, we had a port, but we didn't have a starboard manning. So we kept, typically on a ship, you're handed an SOE, which is a very broad schedule of things you want to do during that underway period. Our challenge was taking that SOE and put a plan of the day level of detail on it. And I mean, when I say detail, when you're working with civilian mariners, you have to call them out. And basically what I mean by that, you got to give them a 30-minute heads up of when you want them to show up to work for the first boat to cross the sill of the well deck or the first launch of the helicopter and, what spots launch in first. And that, we, to drive that to that level of detail is what's required. And you know, when you're dealing with many different cultures from our coalition partners, and you know, the many cultures of how the crew was operating, that was a challenge, but we got it done. But you know, to sum up what I was just pontificating, trust was the key word. Trust that the commanders had in me, and trust that the I had in my commanders. They let me alone, and we got the mission done.
Maybe you could talk a little bit more about that mission. So we talked about capabilities, we talked about adapting, but actual missions in theater. So like we said at the beginning of the podcast, this is originally going to be an Air Sea Battle podcast with Colonel Hams, but now we're talking about essentially air land or sea land battle, because we're talking about operating with the Army. So maybe you could talk a little bit in what you're allowed to say. I know IMC Max, it was very public, the Army was operating with us. Is talk about operating with the Army, what that was like, what kind of capabilities that gave the Ponce, and operating with the Riverine units as well. Because when we think about maritime security, it's a lot of, ooh, jet planes and carriers and destroyers launching missiles. But this is something very different, and it's something very interesting, and it gives us something else to bring to the table, and maybe you could talk to that.
Well, that's a good question. And we knew that we were probably going to do some mine countermeasure ops and some special ops. But, you know, until we got to the Persian Gulf, and sat, you know, we pulled into Bahrain on July the 10th of, 2012, and immediately embarked on a lot of interoperability missions. And we interacted, I guess you would say, with the mine countermeasure folks, the HM-15, their helos, their EOD divers, the Riverine guys came out, and we went down with the special operations folks and operated with them. We went up north in the NAG, and we operated with the, like you said, the Army. And I tell you, those are a great bunch of soldiers. And I call them shipmates, because I'll tell you, when they hit the decks, they chipped right in. Just a credit to the leadership that was out there. Those soldiers just, you know, they were cleaning and cooking and just having fun along with the sailors. And we did those kind of operations, and, you know, the culminating events were the international mine countermeasure exercises. But, you know, we do the astern refuelings with the MCMs, the PCs that are out there. One of our big missions was a repair mission. We have a lot of repair shops on board. So, you know, our quay mates there at Mina Salman in Bahrain, you know, we saw a lot of the sailors come down to our repair shops and work. And
they, yeah, I was one of them.
They usually show up around lunchtime, because I'll tell you, the civilian mariners still cook from scratch, and that was some pretty good chow. But those were the flavor of missions we did out there. You know, we had the Scan Eagle on board, so we had ISR capability, and that was pretty much the gist of it. I know, you know, I took it from decommissioning up to an operational level. You know, Dale Maxey's in command right now, and he couldn't pick a better guy. He has just taken what we had achieved to the next level. But those are the type of missions we had, and again, those are just the entrees of a menu that allowed interfaces with the environment. And I always come back to that, because at some point you got to ask that question: how do you define an AFSB? Yeah, that was our designation, but you know, through the years, many types of ships have been AFSBs. But you know, to have a crane, a flight deck, and a well deck, and a command and control suite that we had was a pretty remarkable capability.
Some thoughts that you have on, and there's two ways to take this question, we can talk about both of them, is for the actual AFSB, the ship itself, what you and your crew and the mariners, what they were all able to put together. What should the Navy take away from that? What are the capabilities that we should really pull? Because it's a unique. They added I. You know, it's AFSB I now, which I think is interim, because they said, hey, this is experimental platform, so we need to add extra letters to its names because everyone knows that makes a lot of sense. But what can we take away from the platform and then from a Navy crew, human beings, officers, enlisted standpoint? What can we take away from the way that your crew and you and the ship had an interaction with that command and control, the way that you operated, that maybe we should take away and try to apply to other ships? What are some things that we can do that you guys did?
Well, let's stay on that word interim real quick. I hated the word. I felt my job was to get rid of that word. But the origin of that word rests with one man, and that's Admiral Harvey. And I hope that you can talk to him and, once again, because I think the big story in Ponce is how a commander could do something so unconventional, so out of bounds of the traditional, and navigate all the minefields of why you can't. And that's not the way we do it. You know, all those attitudes, how he was able, him and the CNO, when the combatant commander, I think this originated with then Vice Admiral Gortney, who was a 5th Fleet commander, wrote the initial RFL for an AFSB, and then General Mattis sent a letter to the CNO. The CNO forwarded it down to then Admiral Harvey at Fleet Forces Command, and they made it happen. And they made it happen in less than 6 months. To make the decision to take this ship, crew it, send it over there and do what we've done. And when you look at how we man, train, and equip ships today and what we were able to do with that, I hope at one point you can corner Admiral Harvey and ask him that question, how he was able to make that, to succeed. To me, that's the real story, because In today's governance systems and all the policies that and the rules, most people in command or at the top know what they want to do. The challenge is, how do you do it? Well, he was able to understand what he needed and get through that. And I hope that one day I'm in the audience when he explains how he was able to do that. So that's the interim, and I think his answer will explain why there's that word interim after AFSBI. My job was to take that concept, make it work, and hopefully give Ponce more life than just an interim platform, because that has a connotation of being something less than ideal or perfect. And I think we were successful. I'm hearing that she might have longer legs than we imagine. If anybody asks me how long do I think that 42-year-old ship can last, I don't hesitate and tell them, hey, she's got at least a decade left in her. And that's because of the talents of the mariners, the MSC engineers. And leading into the second part of your question there, what crewing lessons learned can we take? You know, there was, you know, I pay attention to Blogville. I keep an eye and an ear and see what's being talked about. And I remember a thread once about putting civilian mariners in the engineering plants on amphibious ships. And I'm telling you, I was raised in the steam plants of the Navy, and I'm one proud engineer. And at that time I was an opponent to that concept. But I'll tell you, steaming with the civilian mariners, I am now a proponent. They just have – it's just a different talent dimension. They go to college for 4 years, and they Every one of them can braze, mill, lathe, weld. It's just an incredible talent. They bring depot level repair capability back inside the lifelines of the ship. And for those readers that are engineers, I'll tell one story to kind of put it in perspective. We had a fuel oil service pump go bad, a mechanical seal blew. That's a positive displacement pump. You can't get this wrong or bad things happen. When we took that pump apart, the rotating assembly, the rotor or the shaft there was just corroded bad. The chroming was gone. And typically that's a depot level. You got to contract it, send it to a repair shop out in town, get it re-chromed and get it back rebalanced and run out and back to the ship. Well, let me tell you, less than 18 hours, the Mariners had that pump apart. They weld-builded that shaft, put it on a lathe, turned it down, polished it, and put it back together. In 16 hours, that pump was back online. I didn't CAS rep. That's a C3 CAS rep. I didn't CAS rep that pump because they could fix it. That's a capability that you don't see on traditional Navy ships these days. So I probably got some peers out there that would rather me not say what I just said. But I'll tell you, when push comes to shove and you're out there and you're on your own and there's no repair facility in the middle of the big pond, it's nice to have that capability steaming with you. Another thing that I'll tell you, you know, when the Navy had, when this was a LPD, those 360 in the billet base, 120 of those 360 were engineers that steamed that plant. The civilian Mariners did the same job with just 46, just about half the manpower. You know, where we'd have 9 to 10 people in each plant, they steamed it with 3. And that's just because of their talent base. Now, I'm not saying that sailors cannot achieve that same level of capability, but there's just a different investment in training. And that's probably the best way I could put that.
And you know what? That capability is out there. I'd say we often talk about sort of fear of mistakes, and that's possibly where all this tech rep stuff comes from is, hey, I don't want to breach a contract, or hey, what happens if somebody does it wrong? But we had an ENC on the Firebolt out in Bahrain, and he and his engineers replaced an aux shaft, not a job that you would not a job that today you would expect sailors to do, but they did it anyways, partially out of pride and partially because they knew they could do it. So that's a really good point: is how much of that capability are we? How much of that hidden capability are we missing? How much can we do that we just don't because the system doesn't encourage us to? So Matt,
let me expand on that.
Absolutely.
Another lesson learned that was jaw-dropping to all the sailors that came on board the ship. You know, we didn't play Durzin or Taurus, the T-FOM. We basically played on the Mariner way of doing business. Of course, you know, they owned supply, they owned engineering and deck. And so we used their systems because all money flowed from the CNO to Fleet Forces Command through MSC. So if the money flows through MSC, we use their system. Now, one of their software systems of maintaining a ship, you know, where we use CSMPs, they use this thing called SAM. Their knowledge management was so far above what we use in the Navy. Their entire system is portal based. The TICOM manages that portal. So if I needed a check sheet, an instruction, regulation, I was 2 clicks from desktop from having that on the screen. So if you are asked, hey, what's the latest regulation on main space fire doctrine, or what's the latest on hearing protection or respiratory protection, I was two clicks away from having that right in front of me. And I was assured that that was the most relevant, the latest, the authoritative document. The feedback loop, if I needed to add something on
the website, the portal?
Flight ops. I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. I thought you were referring to the portal, but okay. So add something to one of the instructions.
As we're setting flight ops, you know, we have that, just to put an example to it, the 7-meter davit. Well, that davit arm is supposed to be horizontal, and, you know, sometimes it's left in the 45 angle, but it needs to be horizontal, lower than the edge of the flight deck. That wasn't on the checklist, so I added it, and I wanted it to be I wanted to memorialize it. So I simply added it to the checklist. I emailed it to the portal manager, and within 24 hours, it was permanent. It was memorialized. The next time I logged on to the flight, you know, the check sheet for flight ops, it was there. So that was easy. That was really nice. And again, if I needed to put a job in, it wasn't a 2 kilo. It was a Windows based format. I could take my iPhone, take a picture of something and then go to the job. It was, I logged in as my name. So all that data was filled out and I said, hey, you know, fix this in accordance. Look at the picture, you know, and the picture was downloaded and the chief engineer, he managed all of that, and then within you know a couple of days it was fixed, and so there was never a big inside our family Bible of CSMP jobs. It was, you know, it was a usable working document because it was software friendly and easily understood and accessible. Another thing, a lesson learned for the Ponce, we had an internet at sea.
That's good. I was actually literally about to ask you about that.
I can't underscore how important that was. And we were a pilot program for this, and it had a dual redundant antenna system. It was air gapped to the gig, so it was its own independent system. It supported 220 people. And I'll tell you, the 20 months I spent on the ship, that's a long time away from home. It made it a lot easier, on the family. When I could wake them up every morning at my time, with, you know, an iPhone or a Skype or whatever. I use FaceTime. I'm an Apple maniac. So, that worked. I could open Christmas presents with my daughter at Christmas time with the wife holding an iPhone and me on my computer. But the operational benefit of that was it relieved a huge burden on NipperNet. And I think that made it worthwhile. If Nipper or Sipper went down, if my SHF went down, I had a redundant way of getting home. An alternate comm path. It was, you know, I could turn it off with one switch if I needed to, if we were doing something operationally sensitive. But I'll tell you, Mariners stayed on Ponce because they're only committed to stay on board for 4 months, but a lot of them stayed because of two things. Number one of them was they made a lot of money out there. And, number two was that Wi-Fi connection. So, huge benefit. I would hope that the Navy would consider that. And I understand why Ponce got it because we were permanently deployed. Deployers probably worth the investment for morale. If it's cost effective or not cost prohibitive, I think that's worth looking at.
Just to go quickly back for the listeners, something to think about when they're writing or considering defense policy, or maritime security is, when you talk about that knowledge management, I think that people often made the mistake essentially a video game player's mistake of assuming that all the units, all the people, all everything has the same level of knowledge and same access to it. So you tell Unit A to go to this position and they'll know everything to do that. But there is a huge, redundant, and varied library of knowledge from ship to ship, from person to person, documents in different revisions. Some are drafts, some are not, some are out there. So this idea of friction and efficiency is, hey, how quickly can I train up a force? How quickly can I make it ready for the fight? Is a lot of time can be spent finding these documents or finding the correct version of the document or even arguing over which one is correct. So it's just one of those inside the black box. It's important to remember that even if you come up with the best tactic, the best instruction, the best strategy, the best maintenance manual, whatever the case may be, is you still have to come up with a way of managing that knowledge, disseminating it, making sure that everyone has equal access to it. So, it's really good that you bring that up just as an optic for our listeners to understand how these processes work.
Well, Matt, it was vital to the Ponce concept with the Manning turnover, that experienced churn that I had with the Mariners that, you know, every 4 months I rotated. And then the IA sailors that rotated on 7, 9, and 11 month rotations. I went through, I think, three Navy crews. I was starting my fourth crew when I left, and then about my sixth MSC, my Mariner crew. So there's that significant experience churn had to be anchored on those regulations, you know, the things that the first crew learned had to carry over to the subsequent crews. And the things that, you know, I learned had to carry over to the following COs. And that was the power of that portalized knowledge management. You were assured that you could log on and get the most recent, relevant, authoritative guidance. And, you know, I learned this at UCOM. I had a J3 that turned everything to portal. You send him an email with an attachment and it went to auto delete. Think about that. He demanded that everything went to the portal. Now he had to take those brash steps to make that happen just to change the culture. But there is merit. If you can push through the pain of change, there is so much merit and getting everything on the portal. And I'll tell you, you know, we used to have these things called command inspections. Well, the Mariners have this organization called, you mentioned it, the American Bureau of Shipbuilding, ABS. Inspectors would come on and they would set me down and quiz me on it for a grade. And I'd have to navigate through that portal and show them, here's where it lists my responsibilities, and here's where you go to get this. And you can't print, like you can't print 20 copies, put it in a binder, and, you know, pull them out when you need them. That is frowned on again. So, because once you hit print on a document, it's old news. It's antiquated. So the portal kept it relevant. And I think that it was like it was vital for the continuity of Ponce's experience, and I think that's something that the rest of the fleet could learn from.
And you know, that's exactly what we do here with Sea Control and SimSec, and sir, your efforts with the Ponce and other writers out there at the bridge and War on the Rocks. That knowledge management idea is a great way to sew this thing up. Before we go with our ending reflections, is just not just on a ship, not just as an officer, an enlisted, an engineer, an operator, or a trigger puller, is the ability to continue that knowledge, to keep knowledge, to keep learning, so that blood, treasure, and sweat doesn't need to be spent over and over and over again learning things that we know already, and even observing them from other places around the world, even with strategy. You know, something is as ephemeral as strategy is the ability to observe learn and remember the lessons of the others that came before you, no matter where they are. Sir, before we close up this podcast, any final reflections, things you'd like to tell our audience? Obviously, there's so many more experiences, and I will consider hunting down Admiral Harvey as a tasker to talk about that I portion of AFSBI. That would be a good podcast, just talking about the internal machinations, bureaucratic bureaucratic's a loaded term, but you know what I mean, organizational function, how you're able to pull something like this off. But your final thoughts, final reflections to give the listeners.
Yeah, and I'd ask you to add another person to that name, a couple more there. You know, I would get in touch with Admiral Busby and Admiral Thomas. I mean, you know, Admiral Busby tells a unique story about a napkin at one of the all flag officer training symposiums that they went to that started this whole journey, and, you know, talk to him about it as well. And in closing, Matt, I got to credit those crew members that served with me out there, and more their families. A lot of the enlisted sailors extended for me out there. They really enjoyed, and that's an incredible burden on the families back home. And as we know, nothing, you know, we're more effective on the battlefront with a secure home front, and they never get enough praise. So, you know, I, if any of them are listening, or if they listen to this podcast, I do want to recognize them. And then for the crew members, you know, I'm just a mere mouthpiece for all the accomplishments that they achieved out there. And then I hope that the Southern accent measured up to their work and at least shed some light on what they did. And if your readers, I hope, would look at some of those before after photos. And by the way, this my first podcast wasn't so bad. So if there's any follow up questions or anything,
absolutely, we'll keep you appraised with that.
I'm starting to get a lot of pings to talk about Ponce around. And anyway, amidst the day job, I appreciate it, Matt.
Absolutely.
Have a good rest of the weekend.
Hey, you too, sir. Everyone, you've been listening to Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab. We are available on Stitcher, Stream, Radio, iTunes, and a whole bunch of other places I'm unaware of that people keep telling me about. I don't know how RSS feeds work, and there's only a certain amount of technical knowledge I'm willing to absorb in the period of a year putting this up. Sir, it's been a pleasure. Is there anything you'd like to plug? I know we're trying to get you out there. I think you had an article about the Ponce. Was that in Stars and Stripes?
Oh, no, I had a PAO come out. It's on the all hands, I think, gives a preview of, you know, when your crew, you got a husband and a wife, a father, son, and daughter, just kind of shed some light on some of the unique culture. I called it Two Cultures, One Crew. But that's on the All Hands website. Probably have to go to the archives to find it.
Absolutely. So if you'd like more details about the nature of working with two different crews and some of the activities that the Ponce was involved in, look up that All Hands article, Two Cultures, One Crew. Of course, IMCMX 2013-2012, big operations that the Ponce was involved in. Good to look those up as well. SimSec, we are available at www.cimsec.org and on Twitter at SimSec. That's at, exact same thing I just said, CIMSEC. Sir, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Matt. We'll see you Monday.